Why do you always hoot for her and not me? That was fake, and I know it. Hey, thanks for coming to Capital today. If you joined us online, we're thrilled you're here, being a part of what God's doing in our community as well. Today we continue a series that we're calling Get a Life, because we're talking about the new life we can live in Jesus. Each week we're working through a new verse or a new phrase in Colossians chapter 3, verses 1 through 17, as the Apostle Paul describes the life that could be ours. A life of peace and patience, a life of compassion and kindness, a life that's free of shame and overflowing with grace. Well, in each week of the series, we're looking at a different aspect of the life that's truly life. But I think I need to warn you from the outset. This message today may go down a little differently than the others in this series. See, today's topic may make some of us uncomfortable. It may make us squirm a bit. But the way I see it is it's better to be a bit disturbed today than to be devastated tomorrow. So let's open our hearts to God in prayer. Lord, I pray you draw us close to you in spirit, that we might hear your voice today. Draw us close to you so you won't have to shout to get our attention. But God, if that doesn't work, by all means, go ahead and shout. Rouse us from our stupor. Stir us to action. May we see the wisdom of your warning and grasp the practical, life-giving, life-saving truth about our lives today. We pray this in the name of King Jesus, who came to save us, even from ourselves. Amen. I love a good proverb. A good proverb is a morsel of truth that packs a punch. No, a proverb doesn't say everything that needs to be said about a subject, but when used wisely, a good proverb makes truth portable and accessible when truth is most needed. For example, perhaps you've heard the old saying, "A moment on the lips, forever on the hips." Whether you like it or not, there's truth in that truism. Is the proverb perfectly precise? No. Nothing sticks to your hips forever. But what the proverb lacks in precision, it makes up for in portability. What if you kept this truth in mind when the server hands you the dessert menu? What if you pondered this proverb when you get a craving for a late night snack? What if you mold over its message each week when you come to church? Church, you ask? Why might I need this proverb in church? That was the question on my lips recently. Some of you know I have been on a diet. And church, for the most part, has been a safe place for me to diet. My office closet is filled with my dumb little diet bars and powder packs intended to be consumed every 2.5 to 3 hours. When everyone around me on our team feasts on their bowls of cheesy blessing, you can usually find me mixing my powder packs into a little dish with a half cup of water and misery. One day, my colleague Chris and I compared soups, and he made the most astute observation. After seeing my soup next to his soup, Chris pointed to my bowl and he said, "Troy, that's not soup. That's what's left in your bowl after you've eaten soup." And he was right. Still, the church has been a safe place for me to diet. Chris and the team cheer me on as I eat astronaut food and lose my will to live. That is until Kelly Johnson brought a couple boxes to the office. Now, the boxes were labeled "Hello Sugar." You know what Hello Sugar is? See, Hello Sugar is the name of a new gourmet donut shop that opened near his home. The shop is far, far away from my house, but Kelly brought them to me. This month's flavors include cookie butter dream made with cookie butter cream and crushed cookies. Or you might prefer the Summit donut made with cinnamon, sugar, Nutella, and marshmallows. Now I want you to note something. They're little. They're so small, they're good for you. At least that's what we told ourselves at the office that day. Okay, let's return to our maxim. A moment on the lips, forever on the hips. It's a real joy killer, isn't it? Nevertheless, keeping that proverb in mind might have prevented me from eating a donut or 12 that day. Remember, proverbs are designed to make truth portable, so it's available when you need it. And the Bible's full of them. Throughout the Old Testament book of Proverbs, the sages repeatedly remind us, wise people consider the consequences of their actions. And they hand us proverbs to remind us. Wise people reflect on the future implications of present day behavior, both positive and negative. Proverbs 28:18, the one whose walk is blameless is kept safe. But the one whose ways are perverse will fall into the pit. The Proverbs often speak of life as a journey. We're all walking down a path, but not all paths lead to the same place. Wise people have looked at the map. Of course, you can't know for sure what looms down the road. You don't have control over everything and everyone you'll meet along the way. But the wise person understands her decisions largely determine her direction. She watches where she's walking. Proverbs 21 verse 16, whoever strays from the path of prudence comes to rest in the company of the dead. Sometimes it's difficult to apply the dramatic language of the Proverbs to our everyday life, so let's be clear. This isn't a promise that the unwise will be haunted by zombies. It's a proverb that reminds the reader there are consequences to our actions. Here's another, Proverbs 14:14. The faithless will be fully repaid for their ways, and the good rewarded for theirs. Now see, this is the simple principle of retribution. You get what you deserve. And this doesn't just apply to evil people. The word translated faithless literally means him whose heart has turned. It refers to someone who set out in the right direction, but took a detour and left the path. In some, it says, you'll get your comeuppance. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but someday, one day, will come payday. What will you earn? Now, that's good news for some people. If you've been generous with your time and resources, if you've been kind and compassionate to others, payday's coming. Conversely, if you've been self-centered, looking out for old number one, then you better watch out. Now, when we read Proverbs like this, we've got to ask, what about grace? And that's a good question. We often talk about the grace of God, which is greater than most of us imagine. God's forgiveness is vast, and his love is immense. We talk about it a lot. It's true. God's grace may, in the end, save us from the eternal consequences of our actions. But you know, God's grace doesn't always spare us from the temporal consequences. In fact, the present day consequences of our action are often a part of God's grace. In his grace, God allows us to suffer in order to motivate us to change. Pain can be a powerful teacher. The wisest among us are quick learners. Here's one more. Proverbs 22:5. And the paths of the wicked are snares and pitfalls, but those who would preserve their life stay far from them. The person who values his life steers clear of the path of the wicked. I like the way Henry Cloud says it. Dr. Cloud warns his reader to play the movie. Think of your life as a movie. There's a beginning, there's an ending. Each scene contributes to the next, each scene contributes to the conclusion. Wise people play the movie. Wise people evaluate how their actions today will affect their future tomorrow, but also next month and next year. Friends, this is the message of the apostle that the apostle Paul wants us to receive in Colossians chapter 3. Now, thus far in our series, in each verse, Paul's painted a picture of the life that could be ours if our thinking and feeling and living and loving align with the way of Jesus. But he also warns us, like the sages of old, there may be a negative consequence to our actions as well. Earlier in the series, we considered verse 5, where Paul writes, "Put to death, therefore, whatever belongs to your earthly nature, sexual immorality, impurity, lust, evil desires, and greed, which is idolatry." And then he forewarns, because of these, the wrath of God is coming. Now, some of you are new to our community. Perhaps you're joining us for the first time. Welcome to Capital. We're talking about God's wrath like we do each week. Follow us on Instagram. Or else. Preaching on God's wrath used to be quite popular in America. We called it hellfire and brimstone preaching. Perhaps the preacher best known for this type of preaching, based on a single sermon, was Jonathan Edwards. Edwards lived in the 18th century. His preaching was a catalyst in the Great Awakening. His most famous homily was entitled, "Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God." It was a gentle sermon. Honestly, his sermon scared the sin out of his listeners. But interestingly, Edwards was not an emotional communicator. He would stand in front of his audience and dispassionately read from a manuscript. "You're gonna burn, burn, burn." Here's a sample from his sermon. "The God that holds you over the pit of hell, much as one holds a spider or some loathsome insect over the fire, abhors you and is dreadfully provoked. His wrath towards you burns like fire. He looks upon you as worthy of nothing else but to be cast into the fire. He is of purer eyes than to bear to have you in his sight. You are 10,000 times more abominable in his eyes than the most hateful venomous serpent is in ours." During his gatherings, listeners were so overcome with emotion, some fainted into the aisle. Now hear me. Edwards' listener had an intimate knowledge of the gospel, but no desire to respond in repentance, so he intentionally chose these words and this tone to get their attention. Now I need to be clear about a couple things. First, this message was not representative of the rest of Jonathan Edwards' ministry. He didn't make a habit of preaching like that. And I'm glad he didn't, because frankly I think he got it wrong. He missed the character of God here and how God feels about people. Now, look, you can cherry pick passages of the Bible that may give you that impression about God, but when you understand the scope of biblical teaching on the matter, you have a much more nuanced observation. Paul says we need to consider, therefore, the kindness and sternness of God. Now, hear me, friends. I know there are people here who have been burned by this kind of preaching. And I want to say grace to you. This is a safe place, and hopefully the words that come out of my mouth won't freak you out today. Hopefully the words that come out of my mouth will help you to not just look at God's kindness, which we'll continue to do so. But hopefully it will allow you to consider his sternness. Now, when you first think about God, you may not want God to be stern at all. But actually, after further consideration, it's not true. You want a God who gets angry. Angry at injustice. Angry at greed, abuse, and oppression. Throughout Scripture, even in the Old Testament, God describes himself as being slow to anger. That means his anger is balanced by grace and mercy. But that wrath has a purpose. Yeah, the Bible makes clear he's not a vengeful or a vindictive God like the gods of Greek mythology. But N.T. Wright says God's wrath is the necessary reaction of true holiness, goodness, and justice to wickedness, exploitation, and every kind of evil. It's the necessary reaction. Scott McKnight argues wrath should be connected with both God's jealousy and to the system of cause and effect which God writes into the fabric of the world. See, consequences are built into the system. A lot of us have the wrong idea about God. A lot of us think God takes pleasure in punishing people as if he loves to cast people into hell. But C.S. Lewis contends, a man can't be taken to hell or sent to hell. You can only get there on your own steam. Elsewhere, he maintains, the doors of hell are locked on the inside. What does he mean? Dallas Willard offers what I think is the best explanation of hell and why there's a hell. And I want to read to you an extended quote. Dallas said, some people not only want to hide from God, but want to be as far away from God as possible. Many people simply do not want to be with God. The best place for them to be is wherever God is not. And that's what hell is. The fundamental reality of hell is separation from God. He says, a part of our problem with understanding hell comes from the way we think about heaven. We think about heaven as some kind of comfortable resort. But the greatest thing about heaven is going to be the presence of God. He has allowed us to avoid him here on earth in some measure if we want to. But if you go to heaven, God's the biggest thing on the horizon. You're no longer going to be able to avoid him. And that would be the supreme torture if you haven't gotten over thinking of yourself as God. Dallas said, God is not trying to keep people out of heaven. He's trying to get them into heaven. Some people think that God is sort of up there with his foot against the door and willing to let people in. Well, he is willing. But the issue is, can you stand to be there? And if you made it, would it be heaven for you? Or would it be something much worse? The only way it would be possible for there not to be a hell would be if everyone loved God, wanted him to be God, and wanted to be in his presence. He concluded, God did not create hell because he's mad. He wants to see people suffer and he enjoys torturing them for eternity. The only reason there is a hell is because God makes provision for what people want. And hell is simply the best God can do for some people. Okay. Let me give you some great news. God gave you a free will. Let me give you some terrifying news. God gave you a free will. Beware. He might give you what you want. In Romans chapter 1, the Apostle Paul describes God's wrath in a surprising way. We see it in verse 24. His wrath shows up by God giving them over in the sinful desires of their hearts. In verse 26, God gave them over to shameful lust. In verse 28, God gave them over to a depraved mind. There's a sense in which God's wrath is him just giving us what we want. Now, friends, this is important. Paul makes clear outside of the book of Colossians, because of the cross of Jesus Christ, those who entrust their lives to him are spared from God's wrath. In Romans 5:9, Paul declares, since we have now been justified by his blood, how much more shall we be saved from God's wrath through him? Followers of Jesus are spared from God's wrath. Now, you're going to help me hold this intention, because remember, it is to a group of believers that he writes, put to death, therefore, whatever belongs to your earthly nature, sexual immorality, impurity, lust, evil desires, and greed, which is idolatry. Because of these, the wrath of God is coming. Yes, Paul acknowledges you used to walk in these ways and the life you once lived. They used to be this way, but Paul clearly has some concern that they might still be a bit this way or might become a bit this way. So how do we hold these two truths in tension? The comfort Paul brings and the caution that Paul gives. Well, friends, if I had to guess, I suppose Paul is warning us that if we continue to stubbornly cling to a life of sin, if we deliberately walk in the same dangerous direction long enough, God may eventually give us what we want. You see, Paul wants us to play the movie. Can you see where your sin is sailing? I bet you won't like where it will leave you stranded. See, something happens in our souls, I think, when we deliberately, consciously continue on a path that goes against the grain of what God wants. That's what Paul's warning about. Something happens in our souls. Do you know you can grow to a point where you no longer want God? I've seen it many times. Look, I get it. You use your short fuse or your sharp tongue or your wandering eye to get your way, to get what you want. But once you get what you want, it isn't what you want, and you've hurt people in the process. You've seared your soul in the process. We've got to beware. And a letter that bears his name, the disciple Peter warns a group of believers in 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 8. He says, be alert and of sober mind. Your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, looking for someone to devour. You've had an enemy. Someone who's made it his goal in life to see you fail. Think about it. If you had a colleague at work who longed to see you fired, wouldn't you be wary? Wouldn't you be on guard? Well, believe it or not, there is someone who is looking for any and every opportunity to use his power to weaken your faith and watch you fail. He is plotting your spiritual collapse. And friends, I'm concerned. Maybe some of us need to wake up and smell the coffee. Maybe some of us need to wake up and smell the stench of the lion's breath before he pounces on us. Seriously, is there anything in your life upon which he could prey? There's a path in Matthew's gospel, chapter 26, in which Jesus warns his disciples, tonight you will all give in to temptation and abandon me. Well, they deny it down to the last one. The disciple Peter's emphatic, I will never disown you. When Peter makes that declaration, he means it. He's heard too much. He's seen too much. He spent too much time with Jesus. There's no way he would ever do that, especially that evening. Well, most of you know what actually happened. See, that's the fatal flaw of the disciple. When we see the sin of another, we say, oh, that'll never happen to me. But Jesus knows better. And he says to his disciples, even though they just completed the most intensive 3-year discipleship program in the history of humanity, he says, watch and pray so that you will not fall into temptation. Watch and pray. He's given us instruction here, friends. These are spiritual disciplines, practices we can practice, which will keep us from giving in or giving up. Watch is the same word that Peter used years later when he wrote 1 Peter chapter 5. When he said, be of sober mind. So let's sober up. What's your Achilles heel? Pardon the pagan metaphor. Look, you may consider yourself a person of great spiritual strength. Perhaps you have whole books of the Bible committed to memory in Hebrew. Maybe you pass the wee hours of the morning humming hymns of the church to your spouse and to your children. But what's your greatest weakness? Pride? Fear? Lust? Insecurity? Maybe your greatest vulnerability is thinking you aren't vulnerable. Without realizing it, I wonder if your selfish ambition is leading you to crush the careers of your colleagues. And you've made it okay, because it's just business. Maybe your pursuit of power or fame is robbing your spouse and children of quality time with you. Friends, beware. Play the movie. Watch where this is headed. Picture your marriage crumbling as you drift apart from your spouse. Picture your kids alienated from you as they grew up with a disengaged mom or dad. For you, maybe it's alcohol. Look, I get it. It didn't used to be a problem. But now you need it in a different way. You tell yourself you can go without it. You tell yourself it's not a problem. But it's a problem. You use it to cope. You use it to escape. You use it to numb yourself from the pain. But drinking only alleviates the pain momentarily. And drinking is creating a new pain for the people you love most. See, Satan knows how to get to us. He downplays sin's wickedness. He makes sin reasonable. But he prowls along the path, longing for us to saunter by so he can devour us for breakfast. So, wake up. Play the movie. I don't think you want yours to end in tragedy. However, recognizing the spiritual battle does not mean we escape responsibility for sin. See, we can't have any of the devil made me do it excuses. Ultimately, you can't blame God or Satan. The Apostle James says in James 1 verse 13, when tempted, no one should say, God has tempted me. For God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he tempt anyone. He says the fact of the matter is, each person is tempted when they are dragged away by their own evil desires and entice. See, James here is using the language of hunting and fishing to describe temptation for us. He says, think of a fish swimming in a lake. He happens upon a plump, juicy earthworm dangling before him. The worm seemingly appears out of nowhere. It literally drops out of the sky right in front of him. It must be a gift from God. And it's okay, because he deserves it. Little fish, he's worked hard. And it's not very often that a fish has the opportunity to enjoy such a mouth-watering treat. The fish takes the bait and is then lured away to his death. No one forced him to latch onto the hook. It was his choice. And you and I are offered similar choices every day. Rarely do we stumble into sin. We know exactly what we're doing, but we rationalize and minimize. It's just a peccadillo, we say. You know what a peccadillo is? It's a cute little word that seemingly shrinks the size of sin. It's just a peccadillo. But actually, giving into temptation is a sort of crisis of faith. We trust the gain of short-term pleasure over the long-term benefits of God's principles. And this applies to all sin and temptation, not just lust or addiction. A woman with anger issues believes in the moment that the benefits of her rage exceed the benefits of kindness and patience. The gossip believes in the moment that the benefits of making someone look bad exceed the benefits of a zipped lip. James says each person is tempted when they are dragged away by their own evil desire and enticed. He references fishing. Then James adds another metaphor, but it's not obvious in English. But in Greek, James personifies the word desire, epithumia. It's a feminine noun. And as he writes, James wants his reader to picture desire as a beautiful woman. He says, your evil desire is an alluring seductress, a tantalizing beauty, calling you to her bedroom. Verse 15, then he says, after desire has conceived. By the way, that word means what it says. When desire gets pregnant, after desire is conceived, it gives birth to sin. When an individual embraces his own evil desire, that desire conceives and gives birth. Now here James implies, temptation itself is not a sin, okay? Take the sin of lust, for instance. I don't think lust is the initial impulse of physical attraction. God created us with certain passions. Those passions aren't the problem. It's how we use those passions. It's the imagination that follows the impulse. It's the meditation on the image. But the image is so attractive. She's so beautiful, so enticing. Who knew that a breathtaking temptress like desire could produce such a hideous child? You've heard the expression, ugly as sin? There you go, right there in James chapter 1. But believe it or not, sin is not the worst of it. Because that child is a child of its own. James says, after desire is conceived, it gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is full grown, gives birth to death. Look, some of us have veered from the path. Maybe more closer to you, maybe just take a little detour. You haven't traveled far. But friends, I'm standing before you today to say I think you've traveled far enough. Okay, you may not be obsessed. You may not be addicted. I get it. But are you, as they say, dancing with the devil? Trying to get as close to the fires of temptation as possible without getting burned? Just like Paul, James wants us to play the movie. Play the movie. Where's this headed? As James warns us, he's probably borrowing an image from Proverbs. The ancient Proverbs personified sin and temptation as a woman. Not because women are especially sinful. In fact, when wisdom is personified, she's a woman too. But sin and temptation is personified by a woman because the original readers of the Proverbs were young men. A beautiful woman provided a vivid image. Proverbs 7 offers a parable. Verse 6, at the window of my house, I looked down through the lattice. I saw among the simple, I noticed among the young men, a youth who had no sense. He was going down the street near her corner, walking along in the direction of her house. At twilight, as the day was fading, as the dark of night set in. Then out came a woman to meet him, dressed like a prostitute and with crafty intent. She is unruly and defiant. Her feet never stay at home. Now in the street, now in the squares, at every corner she lurks. She took hold of him and kissed him. And with a brazen face, she said, today I fulfilled my vows and I have food from my fellowship offering at home. So I came out to meet you. I looked for you and I have found you. By the way, the meat of a fellowship offering was not entirely consumed by fire. The person making the offering was instructed to take the meat home and consume it that day. Which means this crafty woman not only offers the young man her body, but a home-cooked meal. She's no dummy. She's throwing herself at the poor kid. She continues, I've covered my bed with colored linens from Egypt. I have perfumed my bed with myrrh, aloes, and cinnamon. Come, let's drink deeply of love till morning. Let's enjoy ourselves with love. My husband is not home. He has gone on a long journey. He took his purse filled with money and will not be home till full moon. The writer of this proverb concludes their tale with persuasive words. She led him astray. She seduced him with her smooth talk. All at once he followed her, like an ox going to the slaughter, like a deer stepping into a noose, till an arrow pierces his liver, like a bird darting into a snare, little knowing it will cost him his life. Someone once described to me the Inuit practice of hunting wolves. I shared it with you years ago. It's not easy to forget. I'm told that in the old days, an Inuit hunter in the Arctic would take a knife, dip it in blood, and freeze the blood onto the knife blade. The hunter would repeat the process several times until he had a nice bloody popsicle. Disgusted? I'm not done. The hunter would then bury the knife upright in the snow, where a wolf could happen upon this tasty frozen treat. The wolf would lick the knife with great delight, unharmed by the blade at first. By the time the blade's exposed, the creature's tongue, numb by the cold, doesn't even sense the pain. As the blade shreds the wolf's tongue, it begins to taste fresh blood, increasing its excitement. By the time the wolf discovers that it's killing itself, it's too late. The weakened wolf wanders off to die, and the hunter follows the trail of blood to its prey. Now, if you love animals like I do, you are deeply disturbed by this image. And I'm certainly not celebrating its practice. Please, please forgive the graphic picture. But my friend, if it keeps you from succumbing to temptation, don't ever forget it. Whatever you do, don't underestimate the deceptive power of sin. I'm reminded again of the words of the sages in Proverbs 14, verse 12. There is a way that appears to be right, but in the end, it leads to death. You might argue, surely my personal choices won't result in my literal demise. And you may be right. But the sages chose words in such a way to create urgency, urgency that provokes action. Friend, let's turn this thing around before it's the end. Look, we're all on a journey, but some of us are heading in the wrong direction. Some of us are heading down the path of certain doom. So play the movie. Play the movie. Think of my message as my way of getting out in front of you. Think of this message as me standing in front of you, flapping my arms, trying to convince you to turn back. Perhaps it's come to your attention that your anger is affecting your children. Or your constant shaming or controlling is chipping away at the love you once shared with your spouse. My friend, play the movie. How do you think this is going to shake out? Oh, he may stay committed to you. She may not serve you papers. But do you realize you are choking the life out of your love? Maybe you've had a habit you've kept hidden. Maybe you nurse an addiction you've kept concealed. Stop lying to yourself. Take your sin seriously. I've seen some of the most committed followers of Jesus lured away by temptation of many kinds. Hear me, friends. I'm not slinging around evangelical guilt today. I'm just trying to get you to consider the consequences of your actions. And I'm trying to get you to insert God into the process. Look, if you're struggling with temptation, whether you struggle with an addiction, whether you struggle with lust, whether you struggle with a subtler temptation to worry, to fear, to get angry, to hold a grudge, the Apostle Paul encourages you in 1 Corinthians 10, verse 13. He says, no temptation has overtaken you except what's common to mankind. First of all, Paul says, there's nothing new under the sun, okay? They didn't have the internet in Paul's day, sure, but they had lust. They had drunkenness. The point here is, your situation is not utterly unique. He says, no temptation has overtaken you except what's common to mankind. Watch this. And God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. But when you are tempted, he will also provide a way out so you can endure it. Look, I know you're telling yourself your situation is impossible. It may seem impossible. But I'm here to tell you, God in his grace is so faithful, he will never let you face the irresistible or the overpowering. Whatever temptation or test you face, God always provides an escape hatch. God's not going to let you take a test you're doomed to fail. He always provides a way of escape. If you want a way of escape, ask yourself, what do I need to do to get off the path I'm on? Some of us may need to take drastic action. Matthew 5, verse 29, Jesus said, if your right eye causes you to stumble, gouge it out and throw it away. It's better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. Now, friends, Jesus is not encouraging self-mutilation. It's hyperbole. Jesus, like many rabbis of his day, deliberately exaggerates to make a point. He says, make whatever sacrifice is necessary to keep yourself out of trouble. He continues, and if your right hand causes you to stumble, cut it off and throw it away. It's better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. Most of us are right-handed. Throughout ancient history, the right eye and the right hand were considered especially valuable. But Jesus says it's better to lose even that which is most valuable to align yourself with the life of God and avoid trouble far greater than the loss of a limb. You can summarize his words this way. Starve whatever it is that fuels sinful passion. Ruthlessly cut it out of your life. Now, I'm going to ask you a question. And I need a modicum of crowd participation on this. It's going to sound like I'm changing the subject, but I'm not. I'm curious. You don't have to tell us what's happening. But did anybody here have a rough week this week? I mean, just life kind of came undone. Not necessarily about the subject we're talking about, but you just had a rough week. Is anybody out there? Anybody out there? You? You? Now you say, Troy, wasn't that nice that you gave away donuts? Ruthlessly cut out temptation from your life. Huh? Look, if you struggle with sexual temptation, maybe you need to limit the types of movies you watch. Maybe you need to avoid certain venues. Maybe you need to stop watching certain shows. Hey, don't give me the I need to pray about it look. You know I'm right. There are all kinds of good things that may be bad for you. Here's a possibility. Is your smartphone a good thing that's sometimes a bad thing for you? Maybe there are certain times of the day when you need to make a deliberate choice to leave your phone in another room. Okay? Smartphones are great. Until we use them in a way that leads us to lust, or watch this, envy, anxiousness, irritation. Get rid of anything and everything that's getting between you and God. Now, remember that may include things that are not sin but lead to sin. How about this one? Political podcasts and programs. Look, I'm not saying they're sin. And I'm not saying you shouldn't be informed. But I know people on both sides of the political aisle who have allowed their political habits to lead to shocking amounts of anger and arrogance. Their listening habits have stirred up fear, causing them to think and speak like they can't trust God for their future. But friends, even as I get specific, I'm not going to get legalistic. I'm not going to lay down a bunch of hard and fast rules. Jesus didn't lay down many. And the fact of the matter is, rules may need to change depending on our individual struggles. Temptation probably looks different for me than for you. I may need to restrict myself in a different way than you do. We can't get legalistic with each other, and neither should we become judgmental. Having more rules doesn't make us more spiritual. Remember, we're not measuring spirituality. We're taking practical steps to keep ourselves out of trouble so that we can experience the life that is truly life. Maybe for you, playing the movie will lead you to cultivate a little accountability in your life. Maybe you need to confess to a trusted friend. Maybe you need to see a counselor. I don't know. But if whatever you're doing hasn't worked yet, then do something else. Just do something. Friends, there's no such thing as harmless sin. Hear me. God's grace is big, and he's more forgiving than you imagine. But there's no such thing as harmless sin. It's not like a cheat day when you're on a diet. Sin has a different kind of effect. It doesn't hurt God's feelings. It hurts you and the people around you. When we let sin entangle us, we cut ourselves off from the provision, protection, and direction from God, at least in part, because we're letting something get between us and him. How about we make a different choice this week? Bow your heads with me. Father, the first person I want to pray for today is my friend who's in this room who is wrestling with shame. And they're kicking themselves for the things they've done wrong. Lord, I think the thing I want to pray over them is that they understand that this message was not primarily directed to them. They might have a different set of struggles. We need to take our sin seriously, but some of us take it too seriously. Or better still, we take our sin seriously, but we don't take your grace more seriously. I pray for that man or woman, if they're struggling with shame, that they would receive your grace today and trust it. As we've talked about time and time and time and time again in our weekend gatherings. May they receive your grace today and trust it and leave here shame free. But as we've learned together, there's a part of your grace that goes far beyond forgiveness. So many of us have a tiny little theology of grace that believes grace is about forgiveness of sin only. But we've found grace is about not just forgiveness of sin, but it's about how you transform us from within so we won't sin. It is that grace I call upon now. For my friends here in the room, for whom this was a wake-up call, their eyes are wide open. Lord, as they see the seriousness of their situation, I pray they immediately direct their eyes onto you. Not just for forgiveness, but for help. May they sense you very near, and may you transform them from within. Certainly give them wisdom to know what kind of external structures they might need to put in place to cut some of this out of their life. But I pray most importantly, you help them to put into practice the right kind of thinking and feeling and behaving such that their consciences, their souls, get formed by you. So that sin won't even look good. I pray for my friends here who might feel a little stubborn today and they're digging in their heels. Maybe it's somebody at home watching this online saying, man, I'm glad I didn't come to church today. Lord, in your grace, no shame, but in your grace, grab them by the hand, give them a little squeeze. And remind them you're talking to them too. And they need to take their sin seriously. I pray that for my friends. I pray that for me. I pray that for all of us. Finally, Lord, I want to pray for the people here who don't know you, or don't know you well. And they just happen to come to church when the preacher's talking about wrath. Lord, I pray first if they've had a negative experience with church, with that hellfire and brimstone preaching, that shame-based teaching, that attempts to cajole and manipulate people to behave a certain way. Lord, I pray they come away from here today with a different idea of who you are and who you've called your people to be. Even in this message about your wrath, I pray they've experienced also your love, knowing that all this is set up in a way so that we could actually come to thrive. Help us in that, we pray. By the power of your Spirit, in the name of King Jesus, amen. Okay, friends, I'm going to give you two homework assignments this week. Here's the first one. John Ortberg encourages us to identify our signature sins. Okay? While your temptations may be similar to others, here's the truth. You do have your own unique version of them. You're special. I mean that in a bad way. Right? Look, if you're a leader, you may be tempted to manipulate people or control people so you can get them to do what you want. If you're a peacemaker, you may be tempted to shut up when you should really speak up. Without shaming yourself, I encourage you to identify your sin patterns so you can be ready for them. Here's another assignment. I was looking back at an old prayer journal this week, and I found a prayer that I prayed quite honestly when I was sick of myself. I was sick of the way I was acting when I was afraid. I was sick of the way I was acting when my needs weren't getting met, when life wasn't going my way. In desperation and frustration, I wrote this prayer in my journal. Lord, help me never reach for something outside your will to accomplish my will. Well, I'm going to invite you to start praying that prayer this week. Lord, help me never reach for something outside your will to accomplish my will. Start praying that prayer over and over throughout the day. See what happens. Stand with me. Here's a verse for the week. Matthew 26, verse 41. Watch and pray so you will not fall into temptation. Put it into practice, my friends. Image on your screen and the graphic that follows will be available for you to download. If you're interested, look for them on our website. Friends, as always, if you'd like to receive prayer, you can send us an email, care@capitalchurch.com. We've got a team of people who'd love to pray for you throughout the week. This is what I want to pray for you today. In a moment of temptation, may you play the movie. May you consider the consequences of your actions so that you'll never reach for anything outside of God's will to accomplish your will, with the result that your movie will end happily ever after. Thanks for coming. Grace and peace.